Welcome to a University of Bath IPR Policy Podcast.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to this event. I'm Nick Pearce. I'm Director of the Institute for Policy Research here at the University of Bath. And I'm very pleased today to welcome you to this discussion entitled Overcoming Stagnation, A New Strategy for Economic Prosperity in Britain. We're doing this in partnership with the Resolution Foundation, one of the leading think tanks in the country that looks at economic policy questions, and much of what we will discuss will reflect or cover the issues raised in this book, Ending Stagnation, which was the product of a big commission of inquiry established by the Resolution Foundation and the London School of Economics, copies of which are available here at the end of the session. Please do help yourselves to those. And it's appropriate, therefore, that we have as our speakers, we've got three great speakers for you today. Torsten Bell, who is the Chief Executive of the Resolution Foundation, worked in the Treasury, the Labour Party, has run the Resolution Foundation very successfully in recent years. We have Anna Valero, who is a distinguished fellow at and director of the Growth Programme at the London School of Economics Centre for Economic Performance. As I say, was a partner in doing this major commission with the Resolution Foundation. And then finally, Professor Diane Coyle, who's a professor at the Bennett Institute of Public Policy at the University of Cambridge, which she co-directs. She's also the director of the Productivity Institute, amongst many other things. So leading economists will have a lot to say about the issues that we're looking at today. People will know, of course, that the British economy has been recently through a period of recession, a big spike in inflation post-COVID, as many other countries experience. But there are deeper, longer-term challenges that this country faces in terms of its productivity, inequality, major regional disparities. There are these long-term entrenched challenges in the British economy. And these are what we want to look at today. We want to discuss what's wrong with the British economy and what we can do to fix it. So we'll have a good focus on policy solutions as well as a diagnostic of the challenges. I'm going to ask our speakers to speak for about sort of 5-7 minutes each. Then we'll open it up to question and discussion. And because we're being filmed, we won't see you asking your question, I will repeat your question, okay? So if that sounds a little bit odd, I'm just doing it because the event is being filmed. So thanks very much for coming today. I'm going to start then with Torsten Bell. Torsten, over to you.
Thank you very much, Nick, and thank you for the nice introduction. It's nice to see everyone. There isn't such a thing as a free lunch, but there is such a thing as a free book. So make sure, and that's quite rare in life as well. So grab one on the way out. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about the problem, and then let's get on to what we actually do about it. So big picture, what's the problem in the short term? And by short term, I mean the last 15 years. And looking for someone in the room, that's kind of a large chunk of people's lives, so it probably doesn't feel very short term. But short term means since 2008, when banks started going bust, when the problem is that the British economy doesn't grow. And by doesn't grow, yes, we've seen the advanced economies around the world grow more slowly since the financial crisis. That is what big financial crises tend to do. But we are the winners for having seen the biggest slowdown in growth. So our economy has seen about half the productivity growth of advanced economies generally since the financial crisis. If there's any degrowthers in the room, anyone want to self-identify as a degrowther? Come on. So there's always one. This is Bath. Come on, there's definitely one of you. Right, anyway, there is one of you. You're just hiding it. The degrowthers have basically got what they wanted over the last 15 years. Unfortunately, then, workers have had the result of no growth, which means wages today are stuck at exactly the level they were in 2008, which is something none of us thought could be possible, but we have managed to do it. What does that mean in practice? Well, if wages had grown at the level they grew at before the financial crisis, after the financial crisis, then average wages in Britain would be £14,000 a year higher. It's not 1,000, it's not 5,000, it's £14,000. That's what degrowth has done for Britain over the course of the last 16 years. Now, it's also not just relative decline. For those of you that have been reading history books, and Nick will tell you should have been, about 20th century Britain, that involved a lot of relative decline chat. Just so we're clear, this isn't just relative decline. We're talking about absolute decline for some groups. So I can see some men in the audience. Wages for men are now below where they were in 2008. Lower. Full-time workers, lower than they were in 2008. And all the youth that are sitting at the back of the room, young people are earning less today than they were in, especially if they're a graduate, a lot less than they were in 2008. So that is what decline looks like. People are actually worse off than they were back then. That's the short-term problem. that intersects with the long-term problem in Britain, which is a country that's relatively unequal and has been relatively unequal ever since the 1980s. It's not that it's got more unequal, it's just stayed very unequal since the 1980s. Put that long-term high inequality together with that short-term stagnation, and you have a smaller economic pie where the rich get a larger share of that economic pie. The result is that poorer households and middle-income households in Britain are now much poorer than middle-income households and poorer households in the similar advanced economy. So just one example, Germany and France, a poorer household in Germany and France is 27% richer than a poorer household in Britain. 27%, £4,000 a year. If you want to know why you get food bank queues when a cost of living crisis ends up, that is what gets us there. Right, then what we're gonna do about it. So what we should first of all stop doing about it is what we're currently doing, which is that we're a deeply unserious country run by unserious people with unserious answers to that question. We think that saying Britain's going to be world-beating will somehow make us world-beating, as if words equaled actions. They don't. You know that because you've all got parents and they said things and they never happened. That's also true for countries. You can just see it this week. We've literally spent a week discussing increasing defence spending to 2.5% of GDP. That's a significant increase in defence spending. It's a reversal of the entire 80-year trend towards spending less on defence and spending more on education and health. How are we funding it? We have no idea. We have no idea how we're funding that happening. We're just promising we'll do it. I'm not saying it may be necessary, right? If the world's a scarier place, we may have to spend more on defence, but we'll have to fund that from somewhere. So what would be a better approach? So let's start with some grounds for optimism. A better approach would be focusing on the things the country is actually good at. And Britain is actually good at some things, including running universities, although, you know, other universities are available. But we are generally quite good at that. And more generally, you know, Britain is the second biggest exporter of services in the world, even though everyone's a bit embarrassed about it. The services we are good at, the market for them, the global market for them has trebled since 2005, much faster than global markets for goods or for other services trade. So if we were getting our act together, there are people who want to buy the kind of stuff that we do sell. And then just briefly to canter through some areas that we need to focus on, we've got to focus on raising our investment levels. Britain is a country living off its past rather than investing in its future. I live in a house built in 1900. I live in a city where the sewers were built in the 19th century, and basically nothing has been done since, which is why if you go wild swimming, which is what all the hippies want to do these days, you've got a 50-50 chance of getting poisoned when you are doing it. So we've got to raise investment levels. That means public and private investment levels. We've also got to do that because the net zero transition isn't just about making ourselves all feel better about saving the planet. It's a very large investment project. We've got to scrap a load of kit and replace it with kit to heat our homes or drive our cars that doesn't use carbon. That requires huge amounts of investment. Levelling up, which is we all say we want to do, that is also a big investment project. If it's an investor save project for the net zero, then it's an investor grow project for levelling up. It means huge amounts of investment, particularly in our large cities like Birmingham and Manchester. And those of you that don't have a house, again, the young ones at the back of this room, we do actually need to build some houses, because at the moment, the average person in Britain, not just in London, in Britain, has less floor space than the average New Yorker, which is a nuts position to have got into. And that's what happens when you don't build enough homes, and you don't build enough homes for year after year after year. On investment, to get some of the trade-offs, because Nick will moan at us if I don't tell you some of the trade-offs, that's got to be paid for. And people who tell you you can just do the investment, whether it's in net zero or whatever else it is, and there's no difficult choices, are lying to you. An economy that does more investment in the short term needs to do less consumption or borrow from abroad. We already borrow from abroad a lot. We need to do more saving. Then we need to be as hard-headed about inequality as we are about getting growth up. So the book focuses on good work, where we are making good progress on the national minimum wage. A full-time worker on the minimum wage is earning £9,000 a year more than they would have done if we'd left the minimum wage where it was relative to prices back in 2000. So we've made a lot of progress on the minimum wage, but we've basically done nothing else. And there's a lot of other areas we need to look at. If you're on lower earnings and you fall sick and you're covered by statutory sick pay and you're off work for a week, you have to live on £44 a week, which you obviously can't do in the real world. Half of shift workers get less than a week's notice of their shifts. And that's completely legal. And there is no excuse for that being the country we live in. Then on the benefits system, you can't keep forever cutting benefits and then wondering why you're seeing more people having to apply for disability benefits and moving out of work, and you can't complain when you see food bank queues rising. Just one fact on that space: if you look at the poorest fifth of households, on average they are £3,000 a year poorer because of benefit cuts made since 2010. It is huge. And because we see them each announced year after year, but we don't add them up, we think, okay, how bad can this difference be? £3,000 a year per household. That is why you've got child poverty rates for large families that now hit about 50%. Half of families that have three or more kids, the kids are growing up in poverty. That is not what success for a country looks like. Taxes are up. Ideally, we would have better quality taxes as well as more taxes. We're not managing to do that. And then end on some optimism. So this gives some political optimism to start with. It is possible to build a coalition for doing things differently, because in previous phases of decline, there have always been large groups that were basically doing well. But we have managed to stuff it up so badly that almost everybody now thinks this is not what success looks like. So 6 in 10 people now say Britain's heading in the wrong direction. The majority of people say they expect their children to be poorer than they were, right? To get worse, poorer between generation by generation, which is almost impossible. And I think that even can't. I'm not in that group that thinks that, but the fact that people think that shows you how bad they think the situation is. It's the middle class, not just poorer Britain, that is losing out from the status quo. And then, is it economically possible? Last point to leave you with. The answer is yes, because we don't need to become as rich as America, and we don't need to become as equal as Norway, and we're not going to manage either. And we don't need to be. And the exam question is not, can we make Britain great again and be exactly as rich as Norway and exactly as rich as America? The exam question is, can we just be normal again? Okay, and normal looks like the same average inequality and the same average incomes as countries we used to think of ourselves as similar to. So Australia, Canada, Germany, France, and the Netherlands. So, like, you know, rich countries in the world, but not the richest and not the most equal. If we just had the average level of inequality and the average level of GDP as those countries, then the average household in Britain would be £8,300 better off. That is why it's worth being normal people. Let's go and do it.
Thank you very much, Torsten. So there we are. The rallying cry for a new generation, be normal again.
Normal. We can do it, team.
We can do it. Great. Thanks so much. A blunt analysis there, but lots to think about in terms of policy challenges and ways forward. Anna, over to you.
Great. Thank you so much. It's really great to be here today. And after Torsten's excellent intervention, I'm going to focus a little bit more on the productivity challenge the UK faces, and how we get businesses and the public sector investing not only more, but also in well-targeted, productive, sustainable assets, which can actually meaningfully achieve the outcomes that Torsten demonstrated as so desirable. So productivity, you know, politicians often will talk about GDP headline growth. It's really productivity that's what drives living standards improvements over time. And that's where, you know, there has been this general slowdown amongst advanced economies, but the UK's has been particularly bad. So if you look at our pre-financial crisis annual average growth, it was over 2%. It's under 5% per annum since the financial crisis. When you decompose that slowdown, so up until kind of pre-COVID, look at the slowdown in productivity in the UK and then compare that to the slowdown in the US, France and Germany, you can see that total factor productivity, or this measure of innovation, has been a feature across those countries. But what stands out particularly for us is that investment has slowed more. And also, we haven't actually seen any positive accumulation of human capital, which some of those countries have seen some positive accumulation. So underinvestment is what does underpin our underperformance. And it is underinvestment in fixed capital, innovation, and skills. So it's really quite broad-based. It's across both the public and the private sector. And that's the backward-looking part. So we need to address that backward-looking underperformance. And of course, as Torsten said, there's the net zero transition. Looking forwards, we need to invest more. There's defense priorities. There's an aging population. There are many reasons we need to be thinking about increasing investment. But of course, the real difficulty here is that there's not really one answer to that. What we need is many different things at the same time. There's no silver bullet, which is why actually this exercise of a new economic strategy, I think, was so valuable. And underlying that book are about 70 reports with much more depth on those topics. Mm-hmm. And if I just give you the example of the business investment work we did, this wasn't simply kind of academic research and new charts. It involved lots and lots of stakeholder consultation with policymakers, with industry, with stakeholders around the country to really make sure that we understood the barriers to investment and realistically what policies could actually help to overcome them. So to start with something positive, and also echoing Torsten, the UK does have a lot of strengths, like relevant strengths in areas that are either have been growing or are forecast to grow. One of them is in services, where, as Torsten said, services trade in the things that we have comparative advantage in has actually been growing faster than services overall and faster than goods trade. and also things that are forecast to grow. So if you look at our comparative advantages in innovation, for example, we seem to be specialized in areas like some areas of clean tech, things like AI and robotics, pharmaceuticals, life sciences related technologies. So we have relevant strengths, and a lot of what underpins that is a strength in our research system, our universities. So these comparative advantages, they're persistent as well. A country can't simply think, let's just get into being good at this new area. Actually, we see quite a lot of persistence in what countries are specialized in, and that's because of the underlying capabilities. So we should really maximize those underlying capabilities and make sure that our growth strategies, our priorities, our trade strategies reflect the things that we are good at and need to protect and build on. So talking first about kind of increasing the amount of investment, this applies across both the public and the private sector. On the public investment side, we've underinvested about of the order of 1% of GDP compared to other advanced economies for some time. And you'll have seen there's lots of debates about whether our fiscal frameworks, our fiscal rules are constraining this. And I think, you know, our inquiry and others like the IFG are concluding that the fiscal framework is kind of dictating our economic strategy. It should be the other way around, that you have a fiscal strategy and then you think about what's the appropriate fiscal framework to discipline policymakers, but also actually achieve improved growth. Because ultimately, the debt to GDP ratio, you've got the GDP as a denominator, and we need to get that up, as we've been discussing. So we propose ways of reforming fiscal rules in a way that could be conducive to higher investment. And in some follow-on work, we actually argued that, you know, you could have, I think this is also what Rachel Reeves actually mentioned in her Mays lecture, if people followed that, make sure that day-to-day spending is fully funded, consider the potentially increased borrowing for targeted, temporary, productive investments, but quality really matters. And maybe you can permit that through looking at net worth, having more focus on growth in the analysis, in the assumptions that go into fiscal forecasting, and perhaps a slightly longer time horizon than 5 years. The issue is that when we're talking about productivity, when we're talking about net zero, a lot of the benefits will be felt after 5 years. On private investment, this is about 60% of total investment in the UK. Obviously, this really matters for driving growth. Public sector investment creates the environment and can crowd in private sector investment. But there are a number of other barriers. And so there's been excessive short-termism. The way we phrased it was that management don't feel sufficient pressure to think about the long-term, pressure from above through engaged ownership, with pensions reforms being a key route to that, pressure from below through worker representation and company decision-making. If you look at us relative to other European countries, many large companies there have the legal requirement to have worker representation on the boards. There's well-known issues in our planning system that prevent construction. And this is not just, this doesn't just matter for the fixed capital investment, but it prevents agglomerations growing. So successful innovative clusters or high value add clusters, you know, when we think of our services as well, they thrive in agglomerations. So those high productivity places are constrained from growing. Of course, there's actually quite specific areas where it's about lab space or it's about data centers where, or net zero infrastructure where the assets simply can't be built or can't be built quickly. There's a whole set of issues around business support for small and medium-sized enterprises. We discuss different aspects of this because when you take SMEs, there's many different types of SMEs. You have a small part of that, which are the high growth firms, which could be the future unicorns. The types of issues they face is not necessarily getting finance at the early stages. It's about scaling up and then making, you know, their presence, the value add, the contribution to the UK economy felt here as opposed to being bought up elsewhere. So there's a whole set of things that can be done there. And I think that's where also some of the pensions reforms that are currently in train and perhaps further action is needed there to consolidate pensions, to allow pensions investment to flow into more risky unlisted assets, such as high growth firms and projects. When you think about the rest of SMEs, there are actually many firms that perhaps want to grow, but they are facing other constraints. They're not going to be a future unicorn, but perhaps they just don't know how to adopt the latest technologies and practices. But they actually want to grow. They want to become more productive. And there is a role there of addressing financial constraints, information constraints, and skills constraints. And things like Help to Grow, which is a big government program being delivered across the country, is the type of mechanism that has actually been shown to work and is being evaluated as well. But then there's this other area of dynamism. So dynamism is something we've seen in decline, not just in the UK, in other advanced economies. And we need this improved process of reallocation. So the resources from the unproductive firms to be reallocated to those more productive firms. So there's this tension, but to some extent, I think we come out like, you know, there's a balance between those two things. We definitely need to have more of a dynamic economy. And that also applies to sectors, so allowing the sectors that can be more productive in the future to grow. So that comes into industrial policy. So I've got little time, but two more points. Industrial policy. So this is where we're not just talking about horizontals or like policies to increase investment overall, but targeting to specific technologies, specific areas, specific places. So trying to somehow use policy to change the structure of the economy. And there is a role for that based on the comparative advantages we have, the places where we can see that there's growth in the future in the UK and internationally, and actually increasingly now national security or security of supply concerns. So we can't produce everything here. What are the alliances we need with other nations to cooperate, to collaborate in critical areas? So we talk about what are the lessons we can learn from the US's approach, the Inflation Reduction Act. There are actually some key underlying strengths when it comes to clean technologies in the UK, things like carbon capture, usage and storage, things like offshore wind. These are still areas where there's a lot of innovation to be done. So channeling support to that innovation and then thinking more purposefully about how we can convert that into jobs and value add will be really important. Two more very quick points, a skills strategy. We talk about how you need a skills strategy to support a growth strategy. There are many gaps, but fundamentally what we need is more higher education actually, but more technical and vocational education. And across that, more adaptability, agility, lifelong learning, because new technologies, net zero, imply a lot of change in the labour market. And the final point is on institutions. We argue also with Diane Coyle and colleagues at the Productivity Institute that we need stronger institutions governing growth policies and industrial policies. There's been a lot of chopping and changing. Stability on its own isn't enough. But if we have stronger institutions on growth, it will increase the likelihood that politicians have evidence-based policies in place that actually last and can have an impact. Thank you.
Great, thank you, Anna. That's actually a very good segue to Diane, in particular to institutions at the subnational level, which I know you'll want to talk about.
I will pick up on that. I'm going to echo some of the things Torsten and Anna have said, but I'm actually going to be less optimistic. because 40 years ago, we stopped believing in the future, and the future's arrived now. And that's what that lack of investment means. And even in areas where we think we're strong, like financial services or the games industry, if you look at how much those industries have invested relative to the value they add to the economy, it's been much less than other comparable countries. So even our success stories are underinvesting in the future. We've got a fantastic games industry, great software, strong in parts of AI, but we've got a huge deficit in trade because we import all of the computer hardware and some of the software too. And I often wonder, why is it that we can't invest? Why did we stop? Because if you look back to the Victorians, they gave us 150 years worth or more of infrastructure, which is now starting to crumble. Or think about the immediate post-war period when the need for investment and rebuilding was very clear to everybody. And we've lost that sense of building a future. One reason I think is the policy flip-flops. We're asking companies and individuals to make investment decisions that will have repercussions for them for 20 years or 50 years in some cases. And even within one government, we get the fundamental policy structures in which they're operating changing dramatically. So our completely dysfunctional government introduces a lot of risk into private sector investment. We don't have enough public investment, as both Torsten and Anna have said. And there isn't even an institutional framework in the UK government to think about things strategically. The only department in the country that could pull things together in a strategic view and think about that very long term is the Treasury. They have a very short-term perspective, and they are dominated by this idea that in the Green Book that investments have to pay off over a relatively short time horizon. And they're using that in contexts that are not appropriate for the context in which we find ourselves, with two big structural changes of the net zero transition and the digital transformation of the economy as well. So part of that, I think, is about the climate of ideas. And in this past 40-year period, we've had a sense that if markets can do it, we'll let markets do it. If they can't, the government will step in. And so they've been seen as opposites to each other. And in fact, they are complements to each other. So changing that framework for thinking about how do the private sector and public sector institutions work together is going to be really important. But what would we do about that? Because we're in a year where it's very unlikely that any sensible decisions about anything will get taken until at least after the election. And the new government, whatever it is, will face this incredibly depressing landscape of the fact that we are much poorer than all the rhetoric suggests that we ought to think of ourselves. So I do have some ideas. We've got to get away from the fiscal doom loop. And Anna, I think, mentioned the need to separate out capital spending in productive investments from current spending. Rachel Reeves has clocked that, which is great. Because if we don't get away from that, if we don't invest in the public sector, in things that will enable growth, it's going to be like those movies where the hero finds themselves in a room with the walls shrinking in and the ceiling moving down. So the public sector has to invest more. That's going to mean more taxes and more borrowing. And facing up to what kind of fiscal regime makes that possible is important. That means the Office for Budget Responsibility has to have a different kind of remit. They're told to look at the costs and benefits of things 5 years ahead, but the kinds of change that we're all talking about will only have their big payoffs in 15 or 20 years from now. So if we invested now in better primary school education, it would take 20 years to have any impact on the skills in the workforce. So making it possible for the OBR to talk about these very small changes in the short term with big impacts in the long term is important. My institute has called for universal basic infrastructure, not income. Income's important. People on low incomes, they're too low to live on. But the infrastructure is what creates the future, creates the growth possibilities. And actually, it's much more egalitarian because those are collective assets. Everybody in the country must have access to an adequate transport network, broadband that's fast enough to access government services, and all of the things that make life decent, like a leisure centre or amenities and clean parks and so on. I think we ought to look at debt finance. A lot of regulators in the water and electricity industry, in the Competition Authority, have been neutral about how investments get financed. But if you finance them by debt, then you're going the people who do that, the investors will want a short-term return, and they'll be more likely to take capacity out of the market and to sweat the assets. And that's been going wrong, as we've seen massively in the water industry recently, and we're seeing in electricity with the lack of capability to make the green transition. So let's stop being neutral about debt finance and crack down on it. We need to think about the mix of private and public. The Labour Party's just announced that it's going to think about nationalising the rail system, and it will take back the franchises as they come due. I think this is the kind of reflection of the climate of ideas that I was talking about. It's either market or government. Actually, a mixed economy of different kinds of operators would be healthier. And we've got one real success story, which is broadcasting, where the mix of the BBC, other public service broadcasters and absolutely commercial broadcasters has given us a really rich and productive economy. It's one of the strongest areas of the economy. It's a net exporter. And I think that mixture of public and private models means that they all have to stay on their toes, and it's served us much better. So I do think we can get out of it. Getting back to normal would be fantastic. But it sort of takes some big changes. And in a way, the big change isn't so much any of the detailed policy areas that we've all been talking about. It's that conception of we need to invest. It's going to cost short term. The long term returns are really worth it. And that means changing the way we think about how the economy operates.
Great. Thank you very much, Diane. Some fantastic propositions there for us to think about in terms of ways forward for policy making. There's a consistency, in the analysis, the lack of investment, the problems with strategic government and the inability to think strategically, and the incentives for longer-term investment, whether they are fiscal, whether they are to do with the regime for supporting SMEs or for skills and training and so on. So quite a consistency, I think, in some of the analysis. I'm going to just start, if I may just get the conversation going, just ask you, Torsten, a question on the savings point, which relates to what both Anna and Diana said about fiscal as well, which is if a country needs to shift towards greater saving for investment, having come from a period where real wages have been stagnant or falling, when it's already sold many of its national assets and borrowed from abroad and all the rest of it, all the things that you describe, how on earth politically do we shift towards greater household saving and greater investment?
That is a very good question. So just to, for the audience, I think it's important to distinguish here between, so I'm talking about how we fund investment at the level of the economy as a whole. So this is for Britain. I'll come on to second how the public sector fits in with this, but we're talking about the country as a whole. And the best way to think about it is in terms of, we've got a given level of economic activity giving us a given level of GDP. You should all read Diane's book about that. We want more of that activity to be focused on investment activity and less on consumption activity. Right? That's the overall, everything we've all been talking about would lead to that result. Some of that trade-off can be ameliorated in the short term by borrowing from abroad, by which we mean us importing some capital goods, say, right? So maybe some computers, computer hardware, importing it from abroad, but then we have to borrow from abroad to do that. And in general, Britain has, I think we've now been running a current account deficit for every year since 1980, sometime in the early 1980s, every year. Mm. Now, there's nothing wrong with individual years' current account deficits, particularly if you were using them to finance investment, actually new investment. In practice, we've been using them to fund our consumption, right? And in the long run, that means lowering future generations' income, because we'll be paying back that. We'll be selling assets. We're either selling our assets abroad or we are taking on obligations here in the UK. And so we shouldn't do more of that. Mm. That then gets you to this question of how do you raise your national savings rate without squashing the consumption? Like, whose consumption falls is really important, okay? And that is, the book does get into this a bit, and this is what it means by trade-off. So I have two answers to that. So how do we raise savings rates? Remember, savings are done by households, but they're also done by firms, okay? How do we raise savings rates? Well, at the household level, we know there's basically only one policy that has succeeded in raising household savings rates, and that is automatic enrolment into pension savings, which has been rolled out over the last 15 years, has hugely increased the proportion of the population that are saving. They're currently not saving very high rates, but the fact they are saving is a huge change from the 2000s. All other attempts to increase savings, whether it's for pensions or other purposes, have basically not worked and ended up being expensive bungs largely to rich households. So all of our tax incentives for savings have not had a big effect on behaviours and have been large tax cuts for rich households. So our view is, at that level, you need to increase the savings rates within auto-enrolment and probably allow the auto-enrolment scheme to provide access to more liquid savings, not just pension savings. And there's some details on that in the book, and there's more in other work we publish. Then we get to the connection to fiscal policy, which is, if you that doing the savings in the way I've just outlined will contribute to some increase in savings, but it won't make a massive difference because it's just not big enough quantitatively unless you had a huge increase in pension savings in the short term. So probably, and this is where you get into the complications for someone governing in the short term, in the longer run, if anything, you might want to act, you're not going to want to be running a massively looser fiscal policy than we're currently running, right? Because one of the ways we can save is that government saves, okay? And this won't be popular with everyone, but so our view is you probably in the long run are going to want to run a tighter fiscal policy, but the key thing is two things. One, you're running a tighter fiscal policy on the current side, because as Diane says, we want to borrow more for investment in the public sector, so taxes are not going to come down because they need to stay up to fund a slight surplus on the current side, right? More than paying for day-to-day services out of tax revenues. And then what tax rises you've got is how we decide whose consumption falls. Okay? Yeah? We save via the state. Taxes are how we extract money from people. They're no longer able to consume. Yeah? And which taxes are rising is how you decide whose consumption is coming down. And that's why it's really important that we look at some of the big flaws in our tax system, which disproportionately, obviously, we tax wages, workers' wages, and we undertax basically most other forms of income and wealth. And that you have to get right if you want to make this move towards a higher investment country. In the short term, for the reasons Diane outlined, you may well want to borrow a bit more. And that's all fine. But I'm thinking the longer term, these questions will come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
I want to add two thoughts to that, if I may. One is that we have funded some investment, or we think we've funded some investment, through foreign debt. And that's been really counterproductive because more gets shipped back into dividends and the investment hasn't happened.
Yep.
So we could tax debt, which is much more better treated by the tax system than any equity finance. The second is that you can give people things to save for. And I think thinking about the Victorian institutions is really interesting because mutuals emerged as savings vehicles for working people to build houses or to provide for their old age. And so I don't think there's an exact parallel now, but thinking about the institutions and what people might want to save for is part of the story.
Great. Anna, did you want to go?
Yeah. So one other thing when we talk about the public sector saving more is to deal with shocks and crises, which, you know, the OBR models, we're likely to see them every few years, as we've just had two very in close proximity. But actually preparing our systems to be able to spend less in response to those things through better data and better targeting of support, so that we don't get faced with a shock and suddenly have to give support to every household, even richer households. The example being the energy price guarantee, which went to everyone. So that's another way we can think about saving over the cycles.
That's great. Okay. So let's open it up to some questions and discussion then. Okay, so a question there, but why has productivity been so resistant to policy, and what more needs to be done with our political institutions to drive improvements in productivity? Let's take some other questions as well whilst we do. Let's do a round or so here. Gentlemen here, yeah. Okay, so a question there on sort of, do we, actually there's a wider point here, do we need global tax regimes? I mean, they're proposing a global billionaires tax. We've already got an OECD minimum corporate tax right now.
Yep.
So are there issues here which are about global governance and political economy, not just the UK? Any other questions in this round? Yeah, colleague here, yeah. Okay, so Krista, is Labour being too cautious, and what mandate will it have for some of the more radical things? I think that's sort of behind your question is, you know, what mandate will it have if it is elected later this year? Okay, so let's start with Diane. Let's start at your end this time.
So I'll start on the politics question, because one thing I forgot to talk about was devolution, which I think is a very important part of the story. We've clearly got a bigger problem of policy flip-flops than comparable countries, and that's because of a combination of first-past-the-post, which creates this incentive to have polarised politics, but also that it's very centralised, and so the national government makes announcements that then affect everybody. Whereas countries that are more federal don't seem to have the same kind of problem at every level of policy. So I think devolving, I would go for a really quite radical devolution of powers, not only for the nations, but also particularly within England. And that would include some fiscal devolution. It might include things like the big cities like Manchester and Birmingham being able to issue municipal bonds for building council housing and so on. Because it's much easier to coordinate at the local level among public and private sector, businesses, unions, civil society, and get that kind of cohesive and strategic view, because I don't think we can do that at the national government level.
What do you say, Diane, to those who say, well, you know, the Treasury has always resisted fiscal devolution within England, and it will never accept tax-raising powers for combined authorities or, you know, high levels of bond issuance? I mean, because, you know, you've all talked about the Treasury and its institutional defaults, if you like. How do you shift the Treasury on questions like that?
I would break up the Treasury. I worked there, it's my first job, and I think that culture is too deeply ingrained, so it needs to be hived off into a Ministry of Finance, like any normal country would have. Normal would be good here, and have a separate business and trade and growth department to focus on strategic issues. So they could have that debate properly within government, because while it's all happening inside the Treasury, that view is going to persist.
Okay, great, thank you. So let's also cover the questions. We've got billionaires tax and the resistance of the productivity problem or puzzle to policy solutions. I mean, perhaps, Anna, you could say something about that.
Yeah, so as you say, chancellors have been talking about productivity. I think it was 2015 that George Osborne had his productivity plan, and before that point, there wasn't that much discussion about the productivity problem, which was already evident. So since then, there was a productivity plan, there was industrial strategy, there were plans for growth. I mean, it's been talked about with lots of the solutions talked about too, but I think part of it is that some of those solutions haven't necessarily been kind of implemented for enough time. There's been a lot of change, or the scale of the problem hasn't necessarily been addressed. So it's not necessarily that we've had all these great policies for some time and still productivity is weak. It's more that we know what we need to do and we haven't necessarily been doing it. Plus, as we've discussed, for business investment, which drives productivity, there's been a lot of uncertainty. Some of that's been macro uncertainty, you know, through exogenous shocks. Some of it's been induced by our own choices, such as Brexit. And some of it actually is actually really micro policy level instability. So if you take corporate tax, that's been changing very regularly. So that makes it hard for businesses to understand the returns on their investments. If you take the business policies themselves, we have Help to Grow Management now, which actually has received further support, but Help to Grow Digital was another part which lasted about a year. Previously, there was something called the Growth Voucher Program, which lasted very briefly as well. So there's often not enough time to let something work and then also evaluate it and learn from it. So these are the types of things that need to be done. But again, that's the kind of horizontal stuff. We still know that there's much more we need to be doing on skills, and that skills is not only important for people's own productivity in terms of their own job, but through externalities. And those externalities mean, you know, more skilled people are more likely to be able to successfully implement technologies in firms, more skilled managers are more likely to be able to do that. So there's just many areas that we know there's much more action needed.
Well, there's a slight danger of everyone agreeing, so maybe I'll just disagree a bit. So have chancellors said the words, it would be nice to have more productivity? Yes, they've said those words. I'm not actually sure it is true that people have agreed how bad the problem was. And I think that has been actually a large part of the problem. Yes, they've said it'd be nice, but if you go back through the 2010s, even after it becomes clear that we're 7 years into a period of relative decline, I actually don't think people did. They might have said, we can do even better productivity plan, but there was no. I don't think there was a burning bridge, not least because if you're George Osborne, you won a majority in 2015, and then they've been quite busy with Brexit in the years since, and then it got messy more recently because lots of countries have suffered from the pandemic and from the energy shocks. So I actually think the danger for us. So if you had to, Diane said she was going to be gloomy, but she wasn't that gloomy in the end. But if you had like Martin Wolf here, okay, he would have been like, this is all interesting. The country's completely stuffed. He'd talk about, you know, the frog is being boiled too slowly, so I'm afraid the frog is going to die. I.e., there isn't enough of a sense of crisis that comes from failure in war, or it comes from more obvious economic collapse rather than just low growth, and so you won't be able to deal with these problems. That would be his take. I don't agree with that. It's too gloomy. But I actually think it's relatively recently that people have, if I judge by like my conversations with, you know, the test is, do conservative politicians who have been governing, when did they start recognising this is really bad? This is what relative decline looks like, and it is quite recently. Mm. And they won't, and they can't say it now. There's an election coming up, so they can't say it for the next 6 months. But it's quite recently. It's after the pandemic. So I basically don't agree with that framing. I think people have now, including the public, actually, I think have also been slow in waking up to. Because remember, for lots of the public, yes, if you're relying on wages or you're paying rent, then yes, you have been doing badly. But if you are retired or you own your house outright and you've been seeing wealth rise, well, then you haven't been. This stagnation hasn't been affecting you on a daily basis. So I think we do. It's only recently we're fronting up to it, and we have to continue with that because otherwise Martin Wolf will be right, and that will one make him smug, and two make all of us poor. But we shouldn't do that.
The crumbling of the public realm, I think, means it is definitely now, coming home to people now.
And that is so that. But that again is a the disaster of public services. That's what makes no sense about the Conservatives' current electoral strategy, which is like talk about tax cuts, talk about defence a bit. Anyone that spends any time with the public, any age group, whoever they vote for, all income groups, the collapse of public services is now the issue. And I promise you it wasn't. In 2017, bit of a row about education systems. Mm. In 2015, you did not have that burning sense of like the entire public realm is going. That is now. So I think to be more optimistic than you, sir, I think the crisis, the burning bridge has like arrived. Mm. On wealth taxes from Bill, so there is work in this area. There's a thing called the EU Tax Observatory that if you're keen on this kind of thing, you should look up, which has been pushing the G20 to try and argue for the kind of policies that you're talking about. So there's a number of important things. So I caveat what I'm about to say with, if you told me 15 years ago we would make as much progress as we have on global corporate tax reform, I wouldn't have thought it could have happened, okay? Mm-hmm. So you may think I'm just too sceptical generally, but so for those of you who don't spend all your time in this area, we have, as Nick says, now moved towards introducing a minimum global rate of corporation tax, not global, but across large swathes of mm-hmm. the... I also started my career in the Treasury, even though I'm a bit less depressed about it than Diane. I'm working on actually those kind of issues. And if you told me we were going to get to where we are now on that area, I wouldn't have believed you. So that's a bit of perk. If you told me we were going to get the US to some degree, but also Ireland and every European country to sign up to a minimum rate of corporation tax, I'd have said good luck to you. And we have got there. But on wealth taxes, part of the problem on billionaires, so people want to say, and they do say this in the US, if we just tax the billionaires, then everything will be fine. That's how we can save the public services and all be happy days. Part of the problem is that the billionaires don't live in Britain, right? So some do, but not as many as you would think. That's all I would say. And that's because modern billionaires look a bit more like the real billionaires. They look like Jeff Bezos, right? And if you haven't got Amazon, you haven't got your Jeff Bezoses, right? So we don't have the really globally rich people very often, okay? Yes, we try and attack some Russian oligarchs, and then we decide we shouldn't attract the Russian oligarchs, but we don't have, partly because we're a small country, definitely now we have a small home market, and more importantly, entrepreneurs in Britain tend to sell their companies off early, partly for the reasons
to American billionaires.
To American billionaires, who then are the ones we want to tax. So there are, you don't raise, people often read the academic papers in the US that say, if we have a billionaires tax, then that will solve, that's the Elizabeth Warren argument, right? It will solve all our fiscal problems. If you run those models on the UK and you just tax the really rich people, which is what they're talking about, you raise diddly squat. Okay, so if you want a new wealth tax, you're going to have to come a lot further down the income distribution, the wealth distribution. Personally, my view is in a UK context, given that we're not going to get global agreement to that kind of billionaires tax, because have you met the Americans? The better thing to do is to focus our energy on sorting out our existing wealth taxes, because they are a joke. Okay, so what are the big wealth taxes? Well, we're talking about on the wealth in it's how it's normally thought about. We're talking about property taxes, and we're talking about inheritance tax, and then we're talking about income from wealth. So we're talking about particularly capital gains tax. There's a lot we could do on all three of those taxes to make them better, and it would make a big difference. Just one example: why does James Dyson own large amounts of farmland? Now, you might think it's because he loves farms and animals. You're shaking your head, sir, because you're a cynic, but it might be, and I don't know, and his lawyers have more money than I do. So maybe it is because he loves farms, okay, and the animals. Or you might think it's because we've got a ludicrous relief from inheritance tax that means all farmland is completely exempt from inheritance tax. Notionally, originally, so that you could pass farms down between the generations. I'm just hinting that when he passes it down, they may not be running. His kids may not be running those farms, okay? I don't think it's probably because he really wants the family farm. Also, the family farm is frigging huge, so I don't think it's like a priority. But the same thing applies to any of you golf? Any golfers here? Some of you golf, Christ's sake, come on. I mean, I don't golf, but some of you are wearing gilets. You people definitely golf, come on. Right, okay, right. Go to a golf club, look at what adverts you will see on the walls. A lot of them will be for inheritance tax avoidance. Go to Doncaster Golf Club, when you get handed your, what do you call the card you get when you go golfing? The thing that you write your score on, whatever it is, okay. Scorecard, thank you. It's lucky you're here, sir. Right, so the scorecard, there's only one advert on the Doncaster Golf Club scorecard for tax planning services, one of the bullet points of which is how to avoid inheritance tax. How do you avoid inheritance tax? You go to a company called Octopus Investments, and they will take your money, they will invest it in non-quoted shares. So long as you survive 2 years, that will then be completely inheritance tax free, because you can use business relief, which was meant to encourage family firms to be passed down between the generations, but is in practice used to avoid inheritance tax left, right, and centre. We can start sorting all of, I've got a long list, but I'll stop there. But
you missed out the really popular one,
which is
revaluing properties for council tax.
Yes, we should sort out the ridiculous council tax system while we're at it. What percentage of properties in Britain pay higher council tax than Buckingham Palace? Come on, let's get some audience interaction going. Put your hands up. Come on, 5, 6. Buckingham Palace is big for those of you not in London. Really big and in central London. Right, 5 or 6. Anyone else? Someone from this side. Come on. Give us a percentage.
I don't know.
30. You're a winner. 46% of properties in Britain pay higher council tax than Buckingham Palace. That is not what a sensible tax system looks like. Including, by the way, a normal semi-detached in Blackpool. It's nuts.
Okay, well, that that tells us quite a lot about our politics as well, the difficulty of being able to do any of these things. But let's go. We've got about 10 minutes left, so let's go for a final round of questions. So, Hugh, over here.
Okay, so, yeah, so first 100 days, I mean, the first budget, first spending review, what are the top ticket items for Rachel Reeves if she becomes Chancellor later in the year? And we, up the back there, yeah.
Okay, so we've got a familiar challenge for economists. You know, does our planning system get in the way of growth? Do we empower NIMBYs? Do they stop us doing anything, building anything? So that's a very important question. Can we have one more? Let's have one more just to finish us off. Yeah, Andy. Yeah, so the role of universities. Some people say we've got too many people going to university, declining graduate premium. You touched on that, Torsten. Others would say, no, universities are, you know, one of your main sources of growth. Anna talked about the importance of universities. So let's come back to that question too. But let's start, Torsten, perhaps if we could start, let's ask you to do the first 100
days.
One.
Yeah. The main lifestyle area, I mean, I always think people that want to be chancellors and prime ministers are usually the people that haven't met them or seen them, because they are terrible jobs. The only thing worse than being the prime minister is being the leader of the opposition. Which none of you ever, the young ones amongst you, just don't do it by accident. It's just like, it will be absolutely disastrous for your humanity and everything else. But on 100 days, on top right, I mean, look, the hard thing in government, amongst many hard things, and it's hard, right? So we're all being flippant about, like, things, people doing silly things or... just to be clear, it is really hard. You're being asked to take hundreds of decisions every day across things you don't know lots about, and you've got to take a view. And so how do you cope with that, ideally? So one way of you cope with that is just put your head down, take loads of decisions, and at some point the civil servants leave you alone. That's not the optimal way to deal with it. The optimal way to deal with it is that you are clear about what the strategy is, so that enables you to take the hundreds of decisions, and it gives clarity, because in the real world, lots of decisions are not taken by ministers, they're taken either by civil servants or by private businesses, private individuals. So you want the ecosystem delivering the change because you're clear about the strategy. And if you're on one thing, then the clarity has to be, this has to be a higher investment future. Like, that's the most important thing. If you take anything away from this, we have to deliver that, because there is no net zero, there is nothing else, unless we move to being a higher investment nation. For Rachel Reeves, that means specifically sorting out the mess that is our fiscal arrangement so that we do have higher levels of public investment and that we can do that sustainably. That's the most important thing. But that general headspace, which is, this is a government that has a clear strategy, which is, we are going to raise the level of public investment, totally, and we will face off up to the trade-offs that that involves. That is the most important thing. And that also answers your question, which is, like, why do we need to deal with the NIMBY problem? And it's also easy for us to, like, it's easy for us to blame the planning system, because the planning system can't get offended, right? Due to not being a person. In the end, it's people that are stopping things getting built, because it's people who are judging their individual interests over the collective interest, okay? Or it's judging today's interests over future interests. And that, which is everything Diane was saying to us before, brilliantly at the start of her exposition, which is, we have got to flip that around. Like, just because you don't want something built doesn't mean it isn't going to be built. You're not entitled to your view. That view has been there for thousands of years. It will be there afterwards. It's not an entitlement. There's never been absolute property rights. And if you think they are, then we're building a graveyard, not a country fit for the future. So we do have to build things. But yeah, having the clarity of strategy, because then you will know, when someone comes and says to you, here's a load of decisions you're going to need to take on, say, the regulatory framework for the energy sector and the water sector, you've got to be clear, because that will involve difficult decisions, right? Like, are water bills going to go up? Yes, they are. But you're only going to be able to take those if you're clear that you're not going to put up with another 10 years of underinvesting. So there's have a strategy, basically.
Anna?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all of that. I would have made similar points. I would just also say, in terms of the political feasibility, I suppose... it is constraining in this pre-election debate, you know, what space there is fiscally, how rules could be reformed. But I think Rachel Reeves May's lecture did open the door to a more permissive approach to public sector investment. And some of the supporting institutions, I think, would increase the likelihood that you do catalyse the private sector capital, you know, this National Wealth Fund, GB Energy. It's really in designing those institutions in the right way. So I think that would be a key priority, to get those institutions there, to be clear that this is a higher investment future and this is a programme of government towards that. And then actually the planning bit comes into that, because this is something that doesn't actually cost lots of money. And it's something that actually there's maybe more political space as well, in the sense that Labour have been able to state they would be quite radical on planning. And obviously the current government they've struggled with that. They are trying to do various things, but some of the previous reforms haven't ended up happening. So I think that's really quite a material issue when it comes to investment, and also maybe the pre-election discourse will be more permissive. In terms of skills, if I just answer that bit, so, and what can universities do? I think there's a lot universities can do, not just because they're a source of strength for the UK, because they're large institutions all around the country. They're locations of innovation activity, they're locations of human capital production, and a lot of my academic work has kind of focused on these aspects. In terms of the skills part, the work we did for the inquiry looking at what a growth strategy means for skills actually highlighted that we do need more graduates if we're thinking about our strategic strengths, things like life sciences, professional services, creative industries. These are all things where graduate degrees matter, and we find that also in the data. We compare to US, where there's occupational skill requirements, and we map them over to the UK, and we find actually, yes, we do need graduates here, but what we should be doing is having more people with sub-degree qualifications. So there's definitely space for more of that. And although there's variation in the degree premium, in our sectors we find strong evidence of a degree premium, so there's still like this excess demand for degrees. But then moreover, if you look forwards at the types of things that are happening, technological change, net zero, the types of jobs, the types of skills involved, they're often quite complex. They need to be agile, or the individual needs to be agile, and actually the types of education you get in a degree really matter for those things. In terms of funding, we need to continue to be open. So open to international students who also have positive impacts on the economy.
It is bizarre that anybody thinks there are too many people going to university because we've got enough skills. We're world beating at this and that, but let's not have too many graduates. And I would just echo the need for a continuum between different kinds of degrees and different kinds of institutions.
Mm. And what about the role in regional policy, Dan? I mean, you were a professor at Manchester before Cambridge. What's the role of universities in driving some, or trying to close some of these regional gaps that we have?
Well, very important, and lots of places that don't have universities have been quite desperate to get one because they have a big immediate impact on the economy. They do create skilled jobs through spin-outs and by attracting other kinds of employers to the area, and they generate amenities in the city centre that everybody benefits from.
Okay, well, we've come to the end of the session. Thanks very much indeed for joining us today. I want to thank, on behalf of my institute, our panellists for their excellent presentations and answers, and to the Resolution Foundation for partnering with us on this today. We've been filming. It'll be available on our website. If you want to find out about future events from the IPR, please do keep in touch with us via our newsletter or our website. But can I ask you to thank our panellists in the usual way?